From Isaiah chapter 40, verses 9 through 17. Go on up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God comes with might. And his arms rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom, and gently lead that are with young. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and marked off the heavens with a span? Enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord? Or what man shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult? And who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and are accounted as dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for burnt offering. All the nations are nothing before him, and they are counted by him as less than nothing and emptiness.
I want to thank Brother Jim for that reading this morning. And I forgot to put the headset on. Is this on? Okay, that's fine. This is the next in my series of phrases that we use in our regular everyday language and conversation that have their origins in the Bible, but are not necessarily one that we recognize as having an origin in the Bible. Now, this week is a phrase, you may have noticed it when we were reading through, but if not, I'll fill you in just a second. But I can honestly say I had no idea that today's phrase originated in the Bible in any way. It was in the 15th verse of what Jim read this morning. And the overall phrase is a drop in the bucket. Now, depending upon what version you're reading, the version that Jim read from said a drop of a bucket, I believe is what his said. That's what the King James reads. The English Standard reads a drop from a bucket, in the NIV translated to the phrase that we say generally today, a drop in the bucket. Regardless if it's of a bucket, from a bucket, or in a bucket, the idea is that it's a small thing, small part of a very large thing. If you add a drop from an eyedropper into a bucket of water, you can't tell by eyesight that drop was added or whether it was not. If you weighed it, it would be, you know, you'd have to have a pretty sensitive scale to note that addition of water. So that's the thought that this phrase conveys. There's another part of that same verse. It says it's like dust on the scales. Once again, you'd have to have a pretty sensitive scale that it would be able to detect dust on the scale in addition to whatever may be weighed. So how is this phrase used in this passage, and what can we gather from it? Well, we need to look at the larger context of chapter 40. The 40th chapter of Isaiah delivers a prophecy of good news to the people. Now, they will be carried into Babylon captivity, and nothing will be left. Now, that sounds like it's bad news, but this is a passage of deliverance. God is going to forgive their sins, and God is going to have it so he can be with them once again, and he can be their God. The glory of the Lord will be revealed to them, and once again he will tend his flock like a shepherd and gather them into his arms. And so today's message is the gospel that we talk about today is just as exciting as this message. The Lord will always save his people that want to be with him. God doesn't set his heart on our destruction. He always gives us a path to salvation. Just like these people were being drawn away, he was still going to be their God. He was going to give them a way to be with him and have him in their heart. But God has made this promise, and really this chapter is talking about, is he able to deliver that? Is he able to keep his promise of delivering them? So this is kind of the question that we're going to look at this morning. And because in that world, when people are taken into captivity, they're generally not allowed to come back home. They generally are kept dispersed throughout the larger nation. And so it was a big claim for God to be able to say, you will come back home again. So in chapter 40, God is going to prove himself by declaring how great he is, and how he's going to be able to do this, and what's going to allow him. So by understanding God's greatness, we will have confidence in today's gospel message that God keeps his promises and that we can appreciate the God that we follow. So God is a wise God, and that's covered mainly in verses 12 through 14. The first point God makes for his ability to be able to redeem them and bring them back into their homeland is he focuses on his vast wisdom. God is able to measure the waters of the earth with his hands. God is able to measure the heavens with the span of his hand. Now, a span is the difference from the tip of the thumb to the tip of the little finger when the hand is extended. He can measure the heavens in that little bit. There's a comic strip from the 80s that I love called Calvin and Hobbes, where the little boy had an imaginary tiger. And I follow a Twitter account that every day publishes a new comic. It just so happened yesterday, Calvin was going to run away to the Yukon. And they asked their mom for a map of the Yukon, and she said, I don't have a map to the Yukon. So they got out a globe, and they said, well, we're here and there. Well, that's hardly far at all. You know, that was just a short distance for Calvin to think about. Well, that is a large distance displayed on a smaller format. Well, God's hand is so great that that's not a very big distance for him either. This just shows the scale through which Jesus is able to present himself and represent himself. It says he's able to measure the mountains on a scale. He's able just to pick them up, and he has a scale large enough. The earth, as massive as it is, God is easily able to measure it. He's able to take its weight, its height, whatever the case it is. We can't take the measure of the physical world very easily. How can we take the measure of God? Now, verse 13 continues with that thought. Who can tell the Lord what to do is basically what's being asked here. Who can be the Lord's advisor? Who can be the counselor to him? Ultimately, who's able to teach the Lord anything? Well, the answer is no one. God doesn't consult with anyone. He doesn't seek advice from anyone. He doesn't need any assistance to do anything that he is set out to do. The reason this has power to that audience is that the god of the Babylonians, Marduk, he had to consult with Ea, the wise. So this earthly god had another. If you think back to the Greek and Roman gods, they were constantly seeking advice or counsel among themselves. God doesn't need anyone. His wisdom and his immenseness does not need any assistance. He does not need to be informed. And so we are in no position, just as they were not, to teach God anything or tell God the way things should be. He doesn't need our advice. Then as we get into the verse where our phrase for the day is found, verses 15 through 17, God talks about how powerful he is. He's not only wise, and not only is he massive, but no one can even fathom really the amount of power that he has. It says the nations, which at that time, just as there are today, there are nations that are powerful in this world. But he's saying whatever power they have, if you add, that's just a little bit of a drop to the bucket that contains God's power. Whatever man feels how powerful and mighty they are, it is insignificant in the grand scheme of how much power the Lord has. It's like, also like I said, dust on a scale. They are totally insignificant to what God is able to do. He goes on to say, Lebanon could not provide enough fuel. And what that's a reference to, the cedars of Lebanon. I'm sure you've heard that phrase. They had all this wood that could fuel all these fires. And all the animals in that country could be used as a burnt offering. And it wouldn't be worthy enough for the power that God has. You could take all of the resources of the entire earth and all the animals for sacrifice, and it would not have been enough. Solomon understood how powerful and how large God was, because when he completed the temple, he said the highest heavens cannot contain God. The temple certainly would not be a suitable house for him to contain him all. So the nations before the Lord are nothing. They may think they're powerful. They may think that they could challenge him, but to oppose God is not going to be successful. It's just like a drop in the bucket. It's not going to change anything regarding how powerful the Lord is. Verses 18 through 20, which extends beyond Jim's reading, but he goes on in chapter 40 to say that God is the only God. There's no comparison to him. He's completely unique. He cannot be explained because there's nothing else in our world that is like him. Certainly can't be compared to an idol. There's no image that could be used to represent God. And that's just one reason why Israel was commanded not to make graven images, because they would just be unsuccessful in doing so. Idols and images are nothing and do nothing. But God is everything, and he does anything he wants. Gods have to be created. Idols are created and moved by the ones they made it. In fact, Isaiah says people have to make idols in such a way that they won't fall over on themselves. Man has to prop these idols up. So we have to be respectful of the Lord, because unlike idols and gods that people made in that time, and you know, in some ways still make today, maybe not in a graven image, but they still have their own gods, but they're not able to do anything on their own, but God is able to. Verses 21 through 26 talks that God is an active God. This is the question in verse 21 that we find here. Do you not understand what God is about? And then it's answered in verses 22 through 26. God is not of this world. He is above the earth. And it says as if the earth is like a stool to him, that he is just able to use it as comfort, you know, to prop his feet up. And the inhabitants are like grasshoppers. Now, I hadn't flown in quite a while, and I've flown twice now in the last month. And there, you always get to that point where you're either just after takeoff or you're, you know, coming in for a landing, that you could start to see individual items, but they're still very small. You could see a car. You might, you know, see a house that you could distinguish, but they're still very, very small. Well, that's what the Lord is saying, how we look to him, that we are just a very, very small thing to him. God looks at the earth, and they are like little grasshoppers to him. As such, God brings the leaders of the earth into bear. The leaders of this world are insignificant before the Lord. He's so massive, he says he's able to number the stars and call them by name. There was that naming registry that was popular 20-some years ago where you could name a star. Well, the Lord already has done so. He knows every star, and he knows which one they are just by looking at them. He maintains the stars of the sky because of his great power and his strength. And because of this, the stars in the heavens stay right where they've been for centuries. Because of God, not one star is ever lost or missing. Verses 27 through 31 talks about that God is everlasting. With all these things in mind, consider the foolishness of the statement that is mentioned in verse 27. My way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God. How can anyone say that God doesn't know what I'm going through? How can anyone say that God is not aware of what is happening to me? How can anyone say that God doesn't see the troubles that we may have in our lives? It's just really false thinking to believe that God doesn't see us and that he's not aware of what we're going through. And it's also false to think that he doesn't care what we are going through. Verse 28 goes further, telling us that God does not grow weary. He's not going to be so worn out that he's just not able to be aware of what we're going through. He's not going to be so tired that he closes his eyes and loses sight of us for a while and we're on our own. No, the Lord is the everlasting God. We wear out, but God does not. God is who gives power to those that need strength, to those that are faint. He gives strength to those who don't have strength. We stop working when we become tired, but God does not. The Lord is everlasting also means that he's not bound by time. We think, you know, our life is long, but if, in the grand scheme of things, our lifetime is just a very small amount of time. Not only through recorded history, the thousands of years that we know that we've been around, but eternity pales in comparison with the life that we have. We live for right now, but the Lord doesn't live that way. He is everlasting. He promises, his promises don't have to come right now, whenever they may be, because to him, time doesn't mean anything. He'll do his work, and he'll act when he sees fit, when it is good for him. And just like I mentioned earlier, we're not in any position to argue with him about that. Verse 31 contains words which were familiar because of a song Chris often leads. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. The people are called upon to be patient and to wait for the promises of the Lord. This deliverance from them going into captivity is not going to happen right away. But just because it may not happen within a year or 5 years or 10 years, he's telling them they need to wait. The children of Israel to whom these words were written were not to look at their current condition and say that the Lord had forgotten them or think that God wouldn't deliver on his promises. Just like they were to do, so too we have to follow the same example. We have to wait upon the Lord. We need to wait for God to accomplish his purposes. We need him to accomplish his plan. And we're told that's how our strength is renewed. God will do as he said. Nothing is going to prevent him from doing exactly what it is he says he's going to do. So if you wait for the Lord, you will have strength in the Lord. We will soar on wings like eagles. We're going to run and not grow weary or grow faint. When your strength and your hope is found in the Lord, you don't have to grow weary. He's constantly there. He's constantly able to reassure us. You don't lose heart because you know God is going to do what he promised. We don't live by having all the answers or explanations. We live by his promises. We don't have to figure God out. We just have to submit to him in faith and believe. God gives strength to those who wait for the Lord to fulfill his promises. We don't need a quick fix. Instead, we need a clearer vision of what it is he's promised, and that we need to find our strength in those promises. So God has promised that Christ will give us salvation, and we have to base our happiness and find strength in that promise. We may not have promised that we're going to go into captivity, he's going to come back and deliver us, but he has promised us a life in heaven with him if we follow his word. And so our loyalty needs to be devoted to the promise that the Lord will come back. And if it's focused instead on man and what man has promised, which oftentimes fails, that is where we can find ourselves in trouble. It will not work to put my faith in God, but also then focus on the promises of man. Doing so, it shows that we believe God needs help for man to do that. I believe it's been a thought that I've heard Mike mention down through the years, that now that global television has come about, someone said, you know, people say the Lord can come because now it can be televised. Well, that's thinking of what I'm mentioning here. It's thinking that God needs man's help to accomplish this, the second coming of the Lord. Now, the Lord will come, and he doesn't need CNN or any other network to help him accomplish that. God is our salvation, and everything that we have in our life will be measured through him. And so if we don't measure ourselves against him, then we cannot find any happiness in him. Gary has the prayer, and after that, we will be dismissed to our class.